Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Richest Men in Town podcast. I'm Mike Freeman, and along with my good friend and co-host Tyler Gould, we're excited to welcome you to our little podcast project. Tyler and I are just a couple of middle-aged husbands and dads driven to live our best lives. We want to be better every day, so here we'll be sitting down with great people. Not famous people, but great people that we admire, to learn their secret to living the rich life. Probably not the rich life you're thinking of. Our guests come in humbled and surprised at the invitation and hopefully leave feeling proud and grateful, realizing just how good they really have it. So pull up a chair, stay a while, and raise a glass with us as we toast our guests to the richest men in town. All right, Tyler Gould, funny thing happened. The other night we're having a conversation with Nick Anderson, and Nick Anderson starts spitting out some names of people that need to be on the podcast. We don't mess around with that. We take action immediately. We reach out to John Garbett. He came on the program tonight. Talk to me, man. What's moving?
I mean, I loved the conversation with John. I know I say that a lot, but John is, just comes across so sincere, so kind, and like such a nice person. It just was, it was inspiring. And, you know, he has a really unique background that kind of blows my mind. And then some of the work that he's doing right now blows my mind as well. So, you know, I just love John's sincerity as he talks about his love of people. He really talks about just loving people, and that really touched me.
Yeah, and even the work, I mean, we do get into some of his creative adventures, and it really did come down to assembling teams of people, yeah. Connecting people, seeking out people. It's not a tagline of the richest men in town, but I am all about, I find myself using the phrase keep going, right? Mm-hmm. To encourage our guests, to encourage myself, man, John embodies that. Yeah. He mentions his latest project, which is heavy work, right? Helping people with substance abuse prevention, like addiction recovery, some pretty, pretty heavy stuff. He referred to that as his fourth act.
Yeah, right? That's true. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
this is just another chapter in where he's trying to jump in and be of service. So, so many good things. We are trying to get better at condensing this thing down. We've spent 2 hours with John. The dust has settled. What's one thing moving?
I mean, John shared some thoughts tonight about God having confidence in us. And even in those times when we don't have confidence in ourselves, or we may be going through some things where we're questioning things, that God has a consistency of confidence in us. And man, that just resonated tonight. I really loved hearing that. And in the context of the work that he's doing with some of the people that he's working with, it was very powerful.
Yeah. And I think he added the phrase, one way or another, we'll get through on the other side.
Yeah.
And he knows we will.
Yeah.
Right. And he was open about his faith. And I think that just really, really resonated and brought some comfort, right? Brought some comfort to our souls for sure. I loved when he beat us to it. We didn't even ask him the question. He's like, hey, yeah, on your document here, one of your questions is, what's my biggest fear? Missed opportunities.
Yeah. What a good answer.
Yeah. And immediately, I mean, even in the after show with us, immediately our brains kind of went to missed opportunities. And yeah. are there some windows of things that we need to step into in order to knock those opportunities out? And then I kind of geeked out with some Randy Pausch and just this idea of we won't regret the things we do, we'll regret the things we don't do.
Yeah, that was a great tie-in. And, you know, he talks a lot about, when he talks about missed opportunities, he talks about the opportunity to make change in people's lives. And I love that perspective from John. I mean, look, Nick, thank you for connecting us with John, because this was a great conversation tonight.
Yeah. And John's hung out with some Hollywood heavyweights, right? We're talking about Spielberg. We're talking about Peter Jackson. We're talking about some really cool things that he's been a part of. But I'm with you. I think his latest chapter is probably his most rewarding work.
Yeah, I mean, his list of friends was like my Netflix playlist. But you know, it was uh, it it was fun to listen to some of those stories, but you could really tell the passion that he has for his work that he's doing with some behavioral health issues and substance abuse issues. And man, an inspiring night tonight.
Yeah. CraftConnectFS.com and this idea of helping family members with their skill development to be able to remember who their kids were.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And love.
Love.
How about we love? And man, don't even get me started. This idea of I'm happiest when I'm living congruent with my values.
Yeah, right out of
Come
the
on,
gate.
Like, John. Yeah,
right out of the gate. It doesn't hurt that John came out swinging with his love for It's a Wonderful Life. You know, that'll
our namesake
real quick. Yeah. But it was a great night tonight, Mike.
Yeah, it's going to be like a George Bailey fan club up in here, but we loved every bit of it. Tyler, thank you for the way you showed up. I love the conversations that we had. I'm going to quote Tyler Gould here. Perspective change. Our perspective changes through experience. I dig that, right? That sounds like a richest man in town swag wear or something. I appreciate that.
Mug. Yeah, we'll get it out.
So to John, thank you so much for the way that you showed up. To Nick Anderson, tip of the cap to you for giving us the tip. If there are folks out there that have some names of people that would make for some great guests on the Richest Men in Town, drop those into our social media platforms and we will track them down. And we really hope that you'll find your one thing, right? Listeners out there, we invite you, sit down, pull up a chair, hang out with John and find that one thing that you're going to be able to take away and apply to your life. We really hope that you enjoy your time on this episode of The Richest Men in Town with John Garbutt. So, okay, Tyler Gould, if you cut me open, I have some core beliefs.
Okay, let me hear them.
Are you ready for these?
I'm ready, man.
Okay, so these core beliefs, they follow me everywhere I go, right? Like I am these things, like personal, professional, wherever I've been, these beliefs. And I you know that they've come up in this space for sure.
Yeah.
But one of them is this idea that we are they.
Okay.
Here's what
Explain
I'm saying.
Explain we are they.
Here's what I'm saying. When somebody says, man, they need to, right?
Yeah.
A belief that we are they neutralizes that. And it actually puts it back on us. So we are the folks to execute the action that is needed, the improvement that is needed. They screwed up. You know what? In my circle, when I'm on your team and you said they screw up, that means we screwed up.
Yeah. Right. Right.
There's something powerful with that. So Abe Freeman, love him. Love him. Appreciate the emails. He's letting it out. He's just putting it out there. But man, when he's got some problems with things, he's like they. And I just want to make sure he understands that we are they.
Yeah, look, I agree with that. I like that principle. I like that belief. Maybe there's a little bit of seasoning that takes place to get that belief to kind of seep into the bones. You know what I mean? But and I will also say that in Abe Freeman's defense, he is drinking through a fire hose right now. And sometimes when you're drowning, it's easy to kind of just, toss some stuff out. Like, hey,
It is kind of funny, right? Cause I'm like trying to build them up, but then I'm over here in Reading and I'm doing the very thing. Right. I'm like, hey, Abe, there are builders and murmurers. What are we doing? And then I find myself murmuring, right?
Yeah.
Gotta walk it. Come on. Yeah. Come on, Mike Freeman. You gotta walk it.
That thing is that it's easy to get in that spot. I did have a chance to read through Abe's last letter or email, and I loved it, man. I loved it because I loved the honesty of it. And I think that here's the cool thing. Like, I have this binder with all the letters that I wrote to my mission president, and I have a box of all the letters I wrote home and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of interesting to go back and look at some of those things sometimes. And you think like, man, I didn't see the whole picture.
You know what I'm dying to do? I'm dying to do. And I've learned early on that this thing is in a vault, right?
Yeah.
I would love to go to Kelly Freeman and say, can I read my letters to you?
I just like wrote letters to Kelly Freeman.
Well, number one,
you were on a
number
mission.
Okay. He claims I didn't write every week. So I'd like to open up the vault. Yeah. And I'd like to be able to bring to light my diligence. There might have been a few weeks, but my diligence in writing. But it would be kind of cool to see what young puppy love plus a missionary name tag, you know, sounded like in a letter.
I can't even imagine.
Some of our listeners are like, letters, what is that?
Yeah, I mean, we have, like, over the last few episodes, we've had some real throwback moments. We've talked waterbeds, MCI cards, payphones, letters. I mean, it's like, it's a regular Smithsonian Museum tour around here, man.
Yeah, so, Americana.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So, Mike, we've had... you and I, when we're not in this meeting, or I call this a meeting, we're not in this conversation that we get to have here. I got meetings on the brain, apparently. We have the opportunity to meet with Nick Anderson once a week, and he kind of is coaching us up, giving us some advice, sharing some thoughts.
Shout out to Anderson Coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. Shout out to Anderson Coaching. And he challenges us with some things, which is fun. And then he also, the other night, he said, hey, you guys, I got some of you guys need to talk to and have on the podcast. And lo and behold, tonight is the night. We have Nick Anderson's recommendation of John Garbett with us tonight. And I'm kind of excited. So tell me, we don't know a whole lot about John. We're kind of
going
in blind.
Here's what I'm excited about. There have been a couple of times, handful of times, actually, I think some of my favorite moments, we're not supposed to have favorites, but a couple of times on The Richest Men in Town. I mean, we're 100 and coming up on, you know, episode 150 or some crazy thing, like creativity has come up. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I think we've actually got an in-house expert to talk to us a little bit about what that creativity looks like when we look at and we're looking on paper, right? We're looking at John's life. Nick provided us some information. I reached out, man, John was down. John does some incredible work with addiction recovery and supporting folks breaking free of that. But when you start digging into like what he has been doing, what he's done in his career, some of the work, you know, like DreamWorks.
Yeah. He produced a movie. And then, you know, I think I would be I'd be remiss if we didn't mention Johnny Lingo somehow.
Johnny Lingo.
Which, again, might be lumped in with waterbeds, payphones, and everything else. But there is a certain era of our listeners that are going to just get thrown immediately back into the Wayback Machine on Johnny Lingo.
Well, and to some, they're like, what is Johnny Lingo, right? So we might have to bring up the parable that is Johnny Lingo, what lessons we can learn, because some people are like, what are you even talking about, right?
Certainly we should at least have a link to Johnny Lingo in the show notes of this episode, so you can figure out who Mohana is and what a 10 cow wife is. Those are some things that you need
to
know.
They weren't very nice to her.
No, and it probably doesn't age well, right?
Yeah, there might be some. I mean, you just said 10 cow wife.
I know, and collectively,
some of the places where we are in the world, 10 cow wife is like, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. So. Hey, so why don't we open the doors? Let's welcome John in and let's have a conversation and see what he's got to say for himself.
Yeah, let's throw a shout out to Nick Anderson for connecting us with our guest, John, and I'm excited to learn more about him. John Garvin, welcome. Welcome to the Richest Men in Town. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic.
I'm doing well. Hey, props to you because you must be a Zoom pro. Many of our guests, that is awkward because people are muted and the cameras are off, but you're rolling.
Well, you know, are people going to see me the way I look, or are they just going to hear me?
They will certainly hear you, but we never make any promises about not showing them our guests.
I don't know. You guys are both dressed up. I feel like I'm really casual.
No. This is a casual affair for sure. So,
all right. Okay, if you say so.
Well, welcome to the program, John. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks.
Well, we're excited to get to know you. We were just letting people in on the fact that you are a connection. The common denominator for all of us is one Nick Anderson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I tell you, can I talk about the name of your show?
Just please.
It is. You can do all the talking.
Okay. No, I just, you know, I have to admit, I've not listened to your show before. So I'm a new listener and I appreciate being part of this. I love the idea of The Richest Man in Town. One of my favorite movies is It's a Wonderful Life. And that line, if people don't know that movie, is from the Jimmy Stewart character. His name is George Bailey, right? At the end of the movie, I think, you know, that's the toast his brother offers, right? To the richest.
Absolutely. Right.
And so as I've been thinking about tonight, you know, and just riffing on the movie, what I love about the movie and why it's been a classic all these years is it's about values. You know, George Bailey had values, right? And if you know the film, there are many places where he gets to a point where those values are challenged, right? I want to go off to college, or I don't want to take over the family business, or I don't want to live in this house with all these kids, you know, or whatever it is, right?
Right.
But what always brings him back, is the values, you know, what's important to him. And I think that's why that movie has lasted as long as it has, because that's something that we all can relate to. Me, I feel like I'm happiest when I'm living as close to my values as I can, right?
Yeah.
Living a congruent life. I don't know about you guys, but to me, that's, If family is important to me and I'm spending time with my family and I'm really with them, then, you know, I'm loving that time because that's what, you know, my value is. That may not be other people's values. They may love spending time at the office, you know, and doing other things. Right.
Yeah.
But the other thing I just have to say, so I worked in the media business for years, so I got to work on a project with Frank Capra III, the director's grandson, great guy. A lot of great stories about Grandpa.
Wow.
And I did a movie years ago with a guy named Bob Anderson, who was played the character of the young Jimmy Stewart character. You know,
okay.
I'm George Bailey, and so it was.
Yeah. It's on the frozen pond, right?
Yeah, the frozen pond. You know,
it was, wow.
Yeah. The guy, you know, was an interesting guy, and that movie changed the trajectory of his life. But I have a lot of great associations with that film. So good for you picking on that as a inspiration for, you know, the work that you're doing with this podcast, because I to me that makes total sense. You know, makes you rich, right? You know, that's.
Yeah. I would argue you are talking to two of the biggest George Bailey fans on the planet, right?
Yeah. I mean,
we love it. We talk about it. We talk about it all the time. It comes up with our guests, obviously, with the show, with our title patterned after that closing toast. And there's so many things in it. You know, I love your point about values. Here's what I love about just the authenticity of the character of George Bailey. There are times when those values are not things he wants,
mm-hmm.
right? Or he's saying these words of like, I don't want to be married. I want to go see the world. I want to do these things. But then his sense of responsibility, his sense of of duty, his sense of values and what is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And has been, that has been with him his whole life. We see early on as a boy, he's, and that's why we love this podcast project, because we tap people that we admire and say, get in here and talk to me about growing up, right? Yeah. Get in here and talk to me about when those values became the values that we see in their lives, when they became their own, right? When they owned them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah. No, no, no. I just think what a great, character, you know, and, you know, if you guys know the movie, you know, you read the reviews when it came out and, you know, the critics panned it. I think what Capricorn, you know, this is just a corny, you know, right. You know, don't go see it, you know?
Yeah.
And that movie, I don't know, how many years has it been? 60 years? I mean, it's
Gosh,
been,
yeah.
Yeah. It's iconic. It's iconic now. Yeah, right?
No, it really is. And, no, I don't know. Just kind of, you know, you guys sent me a lot of questions, and I know there's an order to this, but I'll just
no order.
No,
no, there's, yeah.
One, you know,
there's
thinking,
no order.
You know, we're talking about values. And so, and again, I'm just sharing kind of my experience. So I'm working in I'm working on a project with a young New Zealand director named Peter Jackson. This is before anybody knew who he was. So I've been in New Zealand for a year. And the movie was really challenging, you know, because this guy had made, you know, kind of $1 or $2 million movies. This was like a $30 million movie. It was for Universal Studios. There was a lot riding on it for Peter, his career, Universal, who wanted to develop a relationship with him. And so after a year, you know, we were ready to go back to the United States. I was there with my family. Had five kids, four kids at that time. So my wife, I have to make sure she's not listening. So she gets pregnant, and she really shouldn't get pregnant for a lot of reasons. And the movie ends, and I sit down with Peter's agent, who now is his producing partner, Lord of the Rings. This is now pre any of that. And the guy says, we really would like you to stay in New Zealand. You know, we've enjoyed working with you. You've been a great support. We'd love to partner with you on future projects. He didn't know that my wife was pregnant, high risk pregnancy. I didn't even hesitate. I didn't even think about it. I just told him, you know, I can't. I got to go back to the United States. And we were going to take a month long, we'd already paid for it, Polynesian vacation. You know, we were going to have fun with the kids. We'd learn how to kayak, you know, while we were in New Zealand, all this great stuff. But that wasn't what was important to me, guys. That wasn't my values, you know. It was to take care of my partner and make sure that the baby she was carrying was going to be healthy. And so we went back to New Zealand. And, you know, and left that group. I don't know if they were in shock, but it was like, oh, okay, John.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine that guy going back to Peter and saying, he said, no.
He said,
right. You know, and like, Peter's like, no one says no to me.
No one says no to me.
I'm Peter Jackson.
Yeah. And I've kind of looked, you know, I never try and look back. I guess that's the other thing. I think of the George Bailey character, you know, I mean, he had that experience where he saw what his, you know, life would be like without the values that he had, if he hadn't been alive, you know, the things, the choices he had made. And I tried never to look back. And if I did, I would do the same thing, you know, in spite of all the success that came after that for anybody that was associated with Peter Jackson, because to me, the most important thing was my partner's health and the health of the baby that she was carrying. And the great news is that baby is now 26 years old. He has a wonderful life, lives in New York City. He's actually a photographer for the New York Jets basketball team.
And, oh, cool. Yeah.
You know, and anyway, it's just, you know, anyway, so we started talking about values. That's kind of, you know, and that's what I've been thinking about, you know, kind of just thinking about sharing this time with you all tonight is, you know,
well, John,
anyway,
where, where do those values come from? Where you've got these ideals about family and taking care of the ones that you love. I mean, where does that come from?
You know, I think it, I have to honor my parents, right? I have to look to the example that they set. And I know not everybody has those kind of role models in their biological family. A lot of us have to find them outside of the family, but they both only children, wanted to have a big family. We wound up having, you know, a family of six. My dad, very successful businessman, man of faith, worked in a lot of communities where that wasn't appreciated or understood, but that was who he was, right? And so so the values, I think, started with them. I mean, just observing them and how they treated other people, how the kind of family life they wanted to have, and it wasn't always perfect, guys, you know, but you know, they loved each other, they loved us, and we and so that I think that started with them, you know, just seeing the benefits of them living a life that was congruent with their values. That was that helped me to have the courage to do the same thing as an adult.
So John, you shared this exchange that you had in an opportunity and you said no because it conflicted with your values. As you think back on more formative years, do you remember a time when your values were tested and you had to stand for them, maybe as a young man? I just wonder if it's like, yeah, if it's forged over time, right? Or has it always been? I mean, and I think too, this answer is varied, right? I mean, some people always believe what mom and dad said, and yeah, some people take a windy journey, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that one of the things that I have always liked to do is try and connect the dots, right? Whether it's for myself or for other people, to take two different ideas and see how they intersect, how they relate to one another. And so as a young person, I was always curious about other people, groups of people, other ideologies, philosophies, music, art, you know, and I was always looking for, you know, I don't know, there's a term people use in the faith community called seeking, you know, looking for truth, right? Looking for knowledge, looking for, you know, so I was always doing that. And I guess what happened to me, Mike, is I just found that in so many different venues with so many different people, I realized, okay, having those values was meaningful to them and to me, and made me part of a community that I normally wouldn't have been invited into or considered to be part of that group. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but you know, yeah, so it's like, you know, it just reinforced those feelings that we have more in common than not. When I was a young kid, and guys direct me, you know, I'm just going to, you know, when yeah, I was a kid, we lived in the suburbs of New York City. My dad worked in Manhattan, and it was 1964, the World's Fair, right? I had a huge impact on me because we went to the fair a lot. And, you know, you wandered through all the pavilions to see all the countries, and you know, it just made me realize, okay, I'm part of a bigger community, right? I'm not just living in the suburbs of an American city. You know, I got introduced to cultures, and I remember the Catholic Church had a pavilion, and they'd flown over Michelangelo's Piazza, the statue that's in the Vatican, you know, and there was a moving walkway. And I remember going on that countless times, looking at that statue and realizing, okay, that was made by somebody totally yeah, different life than I did, but a person of faith, you know, that and that was a way for him to express that faith, was to create that that piece of sculpture. So, you know, it's like I feel fortunate I've been able to make those connections.
How old were you?
Oh, I was 10
that statue.
Yeah, you know, 10, 11 years old, right? You mm-hmm. know? And at the same fair, the LDS Faith had a pavilion, and they had the Christus statue, you know, which has now become their kind of emblem, right? Their logo, if you will, you know?
Yeah.
And so you just, and that was the first time I'd seen that that statue was at that fair, you know? So it just, that's a great question. You know, I think it was a combination of parents, just a combination of me being curious and wanting to explore a lot of different things and meet a lot of different people. And people were kind to me and taught me and gave me a chance to participate and feel like I was a part of their community. And so, you know, it was a cumulative, I guess, Mike, you know, experience that where things build on top of one another, you know. So
I love that idea, John, though, of seeking and just kind of trying, looking for truth, but not necessarily in an isolated area, right? You're expanding, looking at other people and trying to understand and connect those dots of where things intersect and overlap. Yeah. You know, there's Mike and I talk about this a lot on this podcast. And I think that's the beautiful thing about conversation, right? And and this podcast is all about conversations. I think I hope at the end of it, we walk away feeling like, gosh, we're a lot more alike than we are different.
Oh yeah.
Those conversations.
Sure. No, I know that's the case. You know, I mean, I've just had too many experiences, you know, over time, to not know that's the reality. And the sad thing is we live in a world, where there are groups of people who love to, you know, share the idea. Well, no, it's you. And then there are all these other people over here, mm-hmm. whoever they are, right? Whatever right. they look like or what faith they're part of or, you know, what their economic condition is, this idea of the other. And I just hate that idea, you know, that they're... Yeah.
And to fear the other, and it's a competition, right? And we're all fighting for limited resources. It's like, yeah. There's plenty. There's plenty, and there's more in common than there is different.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's like the George Bailey, you know, he makes the housing, you know, affordable housing, you know, in his day, you know. And what is it, Potter that says, you know, or his Potter secretary says, look, these are not just, you know, shacks, these are great homes, man. I'd live in a home like this, you know. I mean, yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, all right. Everybody's entitled to that. There's no other, you know, everybody's entitled to a home, you know, a safe place to be, a roof over their head, food on the table, you know, and you know, so
John is inspiring me to say goodnight to you guys and go plug that movie in.
Yeah, last night, yeah, exactly.
Last night attended.
It's your fault, guys. I'm thinking about that movie too much. You know.
No, last night I attended a pop concert by our good friend Gavin Spencer, and he dropped in a couple Les Mis numbers, and it was like, oh, Kelly, we got to go home. We got to watch some Les Mis tonight. Like, it's got to happen. Yeah, and now tonight it's got to be. It's got to be. It's a Wonderful Life. And. Okay. Feels like Christmas.
Yeah.
We're getting there. But you know, I love the irony of that. If we can just talk about George Bailey for a quick second. You know, he spent that film trying to escape his values, right? And trying to get away from it. And at the end, when he's in that room filled with people, it was because of the commonality that they all had in those values. That they were gathered together and rallied together. And I feel like there's so much symbolism just in that last scene where all of these people from varied backgrounds, from varied, you know, levels of success or what they would consider not successful. And yet they're all rallying around each other and lifting each other up. And to me, that's what we're looking for, right? That's encapsulates, John, that idea of seeking and connecting dots and being able to look at others and say, hey, we maybe have different beliefs or different backgrounds, but we actually are very similar in how we feel towards each other and towards our fellow man.
Yeah, no, Tyler, that's a great comment. And the other thing you love about that scene is that everybody's celebrating that moment with what they have, right? You know, somebody, you know, the maid drops in the money she was saving to get married in, right?
Right.
Somebody brings in the watch or whatever, you know, and it's just a great modeling of you know, how we can, you know, contribute and celebrate, you know, those values. You know, we don't have to write a big check. You know, people gave what they had.
Yeah.
And to me, wow, you know, that makes that even more powerful. So I love that idea of that final scene.
John, can we dig in here a little bit? I love, I don't know if you're aware, but Nick shared with us a little bit of the work that you've been up to throughout your life. And we've had some guests stumble on in our conversations with them. We've stumbled on this idea of creativity.
Right.
And I think that I've developed a little bit wider of an understanding of what it means to be creative, what it means to create. But clearly you are passionate about creativity. And I'm curious to know a little bit of what that journey looked like. How did you, like you jumped into New Zealand with Peter Jackson. I would love to find out a little bit about what that journey looked like to get you to places where you're hanging out with Peter Jackson and the like in New Zealand. So back me up a little bit. I mean, the world is a wide place, especially for somebody who's curious and who's seeking.
All right. Okay. So,
picture.
All right. So, growing up, I loved to watch television, right? My Swedish grandmother, who I loved, you know, didn't have a television in her home. She called it the idiot box, right? So, but I love to watch TV.
You might have been onto something sometimes.
Yeah, you might have been onto something. This was, you know, a long time ago. So I always loved TV. I always loved media. I always loved telling the stories, you know, and I always thought that's something I would like to do. So I studied theater, got an undergraduate and a master's in theater, and got interested in what we call producing, you know, assembling creative elements to help tell a story. And then through a series of circumstances, I wound up in Los Angeles and started working in the entertainment industry. Worked for ABC and Fox, and then had an opportunity to work at the Walt Disney Company, starting in television and then moved into feature films. And what I found very satisfying was assembling teams of people to tell a story, to help tell a story. So the writers and working with the directors and the crew people, and had a lot of wonderful mentors that helped me over the years, believed in me and gave me opportunities. And you know, it included everybody from the CEO of the company to just my fellow workers, people that, you know, gave me opportunities, you know, that were so kind to me. And one of my early mentors, one of the questions you ask, one of my early producing mentors said, John, if you're going to work in this industry, this is my advice. Never let them see you sweat. Right. Never let them see. You might be not knowing what you're going to do ahead of time. Okay. Not knowing the situation you're in, the people you're working with, what's going to happen tomorrow, but always maintain a calm, collected demeanor. Always keep a smile on your face and be as positive as you can, even though things are difficult. And those are qualities that a lot of people have, but in the entertainment industry, they need to have more of that, because it's a very stressful experience. You know, if you have friends that work in that business, it's actually a horrible business for a lot of reasons, you know. But so over the course of time, you know, I got a chance to work at a lot of different places. I worked for Steven Spielberg, his company, for a couple of years during what I think are the most productive period in his life. During the time I was there, he made two movies, Jurassic Park, the first one, which was the highest grossing movie of all time at that moment. And he made another little movie called Schindler's List, right?
Wow.
And this guy is shooting Schindler's List in Poland, right? And at night, during the day, shooting that movie. And at night, he's editing with the team of people in Los Angeles, Jurassic Park. And so I've had the opportunity to kind of work with a lot of creative people, and I'm just standing in awe of them. I mean, these are people who they're special, I guess. I don't know how else to describe it. They're different from me and from you, from all of us. You know, they have this kind of gift and ability, particularly as storytellers in the media world. One of my other mentors who got me to Peter Jackson was a man named Robert Zemeckis. He did the Back to the Future movies and Forrest Gump and so many wonderful things. And he was just kind to me, you know, gave me an opportunity. So I wouldn't have been able to do anything without wonderful people. One of my mentors, is a wonderful man named Jerry Mullen, who introduced me to Spielberg, and Kathleen Kennedy was another mentor. She now runs Lucas Projects. You know, so I just have had this blessing as I look back of people kind of coming into my life or being put into my life that gave me opportunities to kind of learn and grow. So assembling, you know, teams of people and helping people tell stories is just something that I, you know, I've always loved and appreciated. And
can you share the feelings you get when the team is done, when the project? Because I will tell you, going to the movies is top five things on my list of things to do. I love all of it. The drink, the popcorn. I'm all in, right? I love the previews. I love everything. I couldn't imagine what that experience is like when you helped tell the story.
You know, Mike, you know, I'm the same way. When the going gets tough for me, you know, I go to the movies. I escape to the movies. You know,
I love that.
That's my self-care. And it's the same, you know, I get the popcorn, I drink. You know, for some reason, sitting in a theater, you know, for, you know, two and a half hours, you know, with people you don't know, this is a unique experience. I mean, when a project ends, of course you're sad because it's been an enjoyable experience, but there's also a tremendous amount of relief, you know, because it's over, right?
Yeah.
At least part of it's over, you know, and I can go home, I can be with the family, you know, it's a 14-hour workday working in that. I couldn't have done it without the support and love of my partner. You know, we've been married 46 years, you know, and was willing to go around the world with me when we worked overseas, willing to take the kids with us so we could have a family life, you know,
I don't want to be stereotypical, but I can't imagine there's too many big families on Hollywood sets.
Not really, no. Not really, no. But anyway, so it's just, it's an exhilarating feeling. And when you see it with an audience, you know, As I mentioned, I wasn't involved with Schindler's List at all. I was at the movie. I was working at Amblin at that time. But I because I was there, I got to go to the first public screening of the movie, right? And Universal wasn't sure about making it as a black and white film. They weren't sure if it was going to be commercially successful at all. They really, really didn't know what was going to happen with the film. But when we, you know, when the lights came up at the end of the movie and we looked at the people around us who had worked on the movie, a lot of them were there. You knew this was special. That to me is the exciting thing. I guess that's part of, you know, you take a story, it becomes relevant in people's lives when you share. That's what you're doing with this podcast, right? You're taking a story. No, you know, People listening to this aren't going to know me. They don't, you know, but hopefully there's something that we're going to talk about that they're going to say, oh, that makes sense to me. You know, what that guy just said, or what Mike and Tyler were talking about, right?
Actually, nothing we say makes sense. It's mostly the guest.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, you know, but that's the thing. That's, to me, that's connecting, you know, kind of connecting the dots between, you know, the story and the people in the audience. And it's a unique thing about media that never ceases to amaze me. You know, a well-made movie. Oh, man, you know, it's so impactful, you know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get into the headspace of a young man who moves from New York to L.A. chasing a dream.
Mm.
Walk me through that journey.
Yeah. Well, you know, and again, it just was the opportunity to just do something I'd always loved. I'd always loved television. I always wanted to work in television. And so I just looked for opportunities to get involved. You know, I looked for an entry level job that gave me a chance to learn. And one of my early mentors said, never take a job that doesn't prepare you for the next job. So I always was thinking about that in terms of my profession. You know, my partner, my wife, was totally supportive of that. If she hadn't been, I wouldn't have been able to do any of that because it's kind of a crazy lifestyle. And my hope was when I was able to make that transition, I would be able to have the feeling that we've been talking about of contributing to making something that meant something to somebody, right? The creative people that I admire, that I've worked with, they make a movie, they write a song, they tell a story because they have an idea they want to share with people, right?
Yeah.
It's important enough to them that they're willing to invest the time and energy. One of my mentors always just say, you know, making any kind of a project is like crawling over broken glass. Think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
It's a great image. You know, you're on your hands and knees and the glass is, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, you've created something that you know, lasts, and is going to have an impact on people. And you know, so, you know, the people who called It's a Wonderful Life Capricorn, they're all gone. And I don't know what they did.
Right.
You know,
yeah. I just think of the ability to create a story, but the ability to create scenes that are unforgettable. When you talk about Schindler's List, I think of that closing scene, here he's done so much.
I could have done more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And you walk away from the theater and I'm an old man now. And I remember how that scene made me feel, and the ability to tell a story like that is a gift.
Yeah. No, it really is. I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, we had an opportunity to go to Israel with a group of people. I've been several times before, but this time, we took five rocks from our little yard and we said to the tour leaders, we need to visit Oscar Schindler's grave. Mm-hmm. So they added that to the itinerary and we laid our rocks on that grave. And there's, you know, if you remember that, the very end of the movie, you know, when they show that, you know,
yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's a way to honor the memory of this guy. Cause while we're making the movie, friends, there were a group of Holocaust survivors they call themselves the Schindler Jews. And they would hang around the Amblin offices at Universal because they wanted to make a connection with the film. They couldn't go to Poland, but they wanted to kind of feel like they were part of that, you know. And I met those people, you know, and it just was a, you know, again, just a great experience of kind of connecting the story. Okay, and you were in that story, right? And I'm talking to you right now, you know, in the of a building, you know, in Los Angeles, you know, and you lived through that, you know. It just so I those kind of scenes that live on, you know, that's you know, that's what's always interests me in media, you know, is making that kind of an impact. So.
Yeah. I love that idea of just good art, right? That evokes emotion and a connection. I mean, you think back to you being 10 years old at the World's Fair and seeing that statue and the thoughts and the feelings, right, that you have as to, you know, just, gosh, somebody created that.
To be awestruck, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's such a great, such a neat thing. Yeah. And for the artist to have that ability, whether it's music, painting, whatever the medium is, right? Just to be able to create something that that evokes an emotional response, it's a powerful thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, people complain about the internet, you know, but I think one of the benefits, you know, guys, is that it's now easier for people to access that, you know, you're never going to go to the to see the Sistine Chapel in person, but you can see beautiful images over the internet now. You know, you can see artwork, you can listen to music, you can watch videos. You know, in my mind, you know, yeah, there's a lot of negative things, but boy, the opportunities that we have now to enjoy, you know, those kinds of experiences that are choosing, you know, from all over the world.
Really, it's made the world a smaller place for sure.
Yeah, no, really, really has.
Yeah.
Where does faith come in for you? Where does faith enter the picture? You mentioned your parents and talking about their faith.
Yeah. No, I, do you want me to mention a faith or?
What does that journey look like?
Okay. Yeah. So I'm a committed member of the LDS faith, right? I grew up in the faith. I think I was fortunate enough to live in areas of the country where our family was the only member of our faith. I went to a high school of 2,000 students. I think there were two of us that were members of that faith. So I've always spent my life surrounded by people that, you know, were of different faiths, different beliefs. And I've been able to have a happy life in that. right. So I've always... the reality of, so I have a spiritual master, you know, Jesus Christ, right? And I believe that that he is real, right? So my faith has always been in him and has been very, very consistent. I recognize the influence of, I call him Heavenly Father. You know, some people call him God. A higher power, whatever people, you know, whatever term they want to use. But I see his influence in my life and the lives of so many people, and that just has been a part of my life. So faith is a big part of my values. The challenge with everything, like we were talking about at the beginning, is am I living my life congruent with those values?
Mm-hmm.
Am I, treating everybody with love and kindness, especially my family and the people closest to me? That's been a very sustaining influence in my life. And what's been exciting for me, I've had so many opportunities of meeting people of different faiths. For a period of time, I worked as doing documentaries of humanitarian work around the world, and just would meet incredible people who were from had a totally different faith than I did, but were more faithful. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
more congruent.
More living a life more congruent than I could ever, dream of, and those people give me inspiration and hope and a desire to be better. Because I'm learning that we're not different. I mean, we have different faiths, you know, however you, you know, but what we're talking about is the core values that are part of me and part of them. And to me, the more experiences I've had with people of different cultures, different faiths, different backgrounds, the more I realize how much in common I have with them. So to me, it's heartbreaking when, again, to hear people say, oh, no, no, I'm nothing like those people over there. People don't understand, you know, because they haven't had the experience. You don't know what you don't know. You think that they are different. If you spent time with them, you'd realize, no, they're not, you know.
Yeah, I think human nature, right? Human nature is when we don't know, we put up walls. Human nature is when we don't know, we fill with judgment, right, versus actually using proximity to draw near to people we don't know to have conversations. And it sounds like that's kind of been a consistent theme throughout your life, where you've had opportunities to have those conversations and you walk away with a better understanding and more similarities than differences.
Thanks for articulating that clearly. Yeah, and that's really been the case. And I feel sad for people that don't. You know, I'll give you a little example. So I work in the behavioral health world. So I work at an agency with people that are struggling with mental health and substance use disorders. This is kind of the fourth act of my career, there are a lot of people the facility I work with that are dealing with gender identity issues, right? And that's troubling to family and friends, and not sure how to respond to that, you know. And I realize, again, this goes back to my family's values, my parents' values. So my father worked in an industry where he worked, this was years ago, and worked with a lot of people that loved people different from my mom, and we knew that as kids. And some of our dearest family friends were people that, I had a different living relationship than a traditional LDS family would have at that time. And I'm so grateful for the example they set, because to me, it's like not an issue. You know, these were our family friends. They stayed in our home. We went on vacations with them, you know, and because I'd had that experience because of the values they had, which is, hey, this is somebody we love. We don't care who they love or who they're living with, you know, what kind of relationship they're in, but we want them to be part of our family. And I'm so grateful for that. And I realized how unique that probably was, at that time, And maybe even as a member of, the faith that I was in. But that was the deal. That was the values that we had as a family. And I'm grateful for that. So anyway.
Well, I love that, because I love the idea of, you know, we talk about when we talk about faith, sometimes that conversation leans towards a focus on sin, which can lead towards a focus on differences, right? As opposed to a conversation of compassion and mercy and love, which are those overarching characteristics of a God or a heavenly father or a higher power that would lead us to acceptance, love, and lifting others, as opposed to building walls, as Mike talks about, and separating ourselves from others.
Yeah. No, Tyler. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And so it's just fascinating, you know, when everybody's different, you know, guys. And I'm not, you know, again, I the empathy that I have for folks is they just don't know because they don't know, right? They haven't had experiences I have. They haven't met people. They haven't, you know, and so they're going off of their perceptions or their what they think is going on. You know, when I talk to people who are struggling, I don't talk about religion. I talk about spirituality, right?
Yeah.
We all have, you know, a spiritual life
as part of the solution, right?
Part of the solution, part of having a happy life. You know, even the federal government, you know, they have what they call a wellness wheel. One of those wellness spokes is spirituality. You know, so you know, it, and I think we just get confused sometimes where we think, okay, those two are like this. Well, not really, you know, that you can have a faith and not be involved in an organized religion. I think it's helpful. It helps me in my faith, but there are a lot of people that have a spiritual part of their lives that are not engaged in organized religion. And yet, as you're kind of suggesting, Tyler, we kind of judge them a little bit and say, well, because you're not in a, you know,
right.
You're not, you know, in the same place that I am in terms of faith. And my experience worldwide, nothing could be more different. You know?
Yeah. Well, totally. Sadly, the opposite is true, where there are members of faith communities that do not have spirituality.
No, it's
yeah. Or it's a social club, or it's social norms that I'm using to raise my family. And it's not necessarily a connection or a communion. Yeah. It's something else.
Yeah. Just a quick story. So one of the trips I went on, and I think about this now, and I realized, boy, I was kind of stupid. So remember ISIS, you know, when they were active? Okay. Mm-hmm. So in 2014, they were very active in an area of Iraq called Kurdistan. And so I got sent there to document the work that was being done to help a group of people called the Yazidis. And these are people that the ISIS Muslims, faithful Muslims, consider to be infidels, because they believed in heaven, and they believed in God, and they also believed in the devil, and there were angels. Very complex kind of faith. I never quite understood a lot of the basic precepts, but it didn't matter because ISIS was killing them. You know, they would... So I go to the refugee camp that's about 12 kilometers from the Turkish border, near the fighting. I don't know why I did this, but I felt compelled to. And I meet a Swedish doctor, Dr. Nama. Okay, this is a single Swedish doctor. She was Kurdish by ethnicity, and she'd been become a heart specialist in Stockholm, Sweden, had a great practice. Well, their people are in trouble, and she decides that she's going to go back and help these people, right? So she goes to this refugee camp. I think there were about 10,000 people in the camp. She's the only doctor there, right? Try to help these
10,000 people.
Yeah. 10,000 people. So she assembles a team of people working with her, right? And then she realizes, oh, you know what? I can heal them, you know, but they need bread. So she gets somebody in Sweden to donate a commercial bakery that they fly to this refugee camp, and she sets up a bakery, and she starts baking, you know, thousands of loaves of bread on a weekly basis to help feed the people, you know, and. Wow. Eventually, the people in her hospital in Sweden says, you can't come home anymore. You can't come back. And she says, okay, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to stay with you, right, and just take care of your needs. I mean, you know, and you think, okay, yeah, why is she doing this? She doesn't know these people. They're Yazidis, which even in that part of the world are looked down as, you know, less than, you know, kind of another group of people. And yet she stays there long enough that she helps people, and then she gets COVID and she dies, you know, from getting mm-hmm. COVID after going through the war, after helping all these people. Well, anyway, as part of that trip, we go to a community called Erbil, which is the capital of Kurdistan. We go to interview a lady who has a very lovely three-level mansion home. And she's opened it to, I think there were six or seven Yazidi families living in that home with her, right? And she's just taking care of them. She's buying food. There's babies. There's diapers everywhere, you know. And I'm interviewing her, and what she's basically telling me is, I'm doing this because I have been given much, and I realized I need to give to these people, right? I mean, it was a basic... You know, it was her faith, right? And it was motivating her to make a difference in the lives of people. And, you know, this has happened, and I've had that experience time after time. Why are you doing this? Why are you trying to make a change? Why are you trying to help people? And it goes back to, you know, I have a belief that I have some connection with these people, you know. And to me, you know, I believe, you know, we're all children of a loving Heavenly Father, right? And so that's my connection, right? And she was telling me in her own way, I believe that as well. And that's why I'm doing this. You know, her sons couldn't believe that she turned the family house into this kind of little refugee center. But that was what she had to do. She was compelled to help other people because she could. And so again, those, you know, I've just had so many of those kinds of experiences that have helped me to realize, you know, that we are, you know, we're all the same.
I love that. You know, you talked to earlier, John, you mentioned the idea that, you know, I've met people who are probably living more congruent with their values than I am. Right. And it's just such a, you know, I love those stories because you talk about, you know, the doctor from Sweden who, you know, makes those sacrifices, and the woman with her home that are making those sacrifices. And man, what a powerful example of just loving people, right? And not judging people. I love that.
Hey, Tyler, as I'm listening to John tell the story, number one, I think that, John, you said earlier, like, those examples inspire me to want to be better, right? But Tyler, it makes me think of a conversation I had with you earlier in the week where you were talking about your faith leader, your stake president recently, or a stake president recently, mm-hmm. kind of stood up and said, hey guys, right? You remember that?
Yeah. If you're busy, right? Let's try to be a little busier. If your plate's full, let's see if we can make it a little more full.
I love that.
I love that too. And when you hear
John talk about that, I'm thinking that, okay,
it's counterintuitive to a certain degree, right?
I can do more. There's more that I can do.
Yeah. You know, and again, I'm sharing some dramatic stories, but the fun thing about this idea is, you know, we can do this every day, right? We can, you know, we can connect with people in that kind of a way in so many different ways. And my challenge always is, you know, to look for those things. You know, one of your questions was, what are you afraid of? Right. And what I wrote down was missed opportunities. That's what I'm afraid of. You know, if I had an opportunity to make a difference and I didn't take advantage of it, or I at least didn't try, then that's my fear. You know, if I'm trying to, you know, to help people or connect the dots for people between ideas or bring people together that have never worked together or whatever it is, you know, it's the missed opportunities, you know, you know, looking back over life, I think, you know, the most satisfying thing would be to realize, hey, you know, yeah, I maybe didn't make all the, you know, there are probably things I would have chosen differently or I don't know, but I didn't miss any big opportunities. You know, I didn't miss the opportunity of telling the people I care about that I love them and showing that I love them, and then the challenge is, how do I do that? You know? So missed opportunities, that's kind of what bubbled up to me in terms of what I'm afraid of, you know?
I had a conversation with somebody, I had a conversation with somebody just today about this idea, like, hey, look, hopefully life is long. Hopefully people are forgiving. The world seems to be a forgiving place. Maybe family can forgive. Time is ruthless and doesn't forgive, right? And that idea of like, hey, look, maybe I'm not the dad I need to be. And when my kid is 40, we have a come together and we have a reconciliation. I can't get the time back. And I think that inherent in that fear of missed opportunities is that window, right? That window of time. I was recently reading some of, I don't know if you guys remember Randy Pausch. He was the guy who, he was dying of cancer and he performed a last lecture series at Carnegie Mellon. Mm-hmm. And it went viral. 21 million people, I think, have viewed this. He literally was talking about this last lecture series is what would be the last lecture that you would give of your life. Well, he was dying, right? So this was actually a really poignant moment for him. And he says this, It is not the things we do in life that we regret on our deathbed. It is the things we do not. I assure you, I've done a lot of really stupid things and none of them bother me. All the mistakes and all the dopey things and all the times I was embarrassed, they don't matter. What matters is that I can kind of look back and say, pretty much any time I got the chance to do something, I tried to grab for it. And that's where my solace comes from, right? A dying man talking about solace has my attention.
Yeah.
When he says he can look back, and when that door cracked open, he went for it.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. No, great, great thought. How do you spell his last name?
P-A-U-S-C-H. Randy Pausch.
P-A-U-S-C-H. Okay. I'm gonna have to check that out.
That's yeah, and he did pass away. But there's also a really powerful commencement address he gives at Carnegie Mellon right before he passes away. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, no, that's great. Love that.
John, can you talk a little bit about the work that you're involved in now? You mentioned the behavioral health and the substance abuse, and what brought you there, and what are you learning from that work?
You know, what I'm learning is compassion. Right. What I'm learning is empathy. What I'm learning is, is the resilience of the human spirit. You know, I get a chance to work with people that have had significant trauma in their life, that have lives of unrelenting crisis and pain. Right. And I see if they choose how they can change. Right. And that to me has given me tremendous hope. The ability for us to be an influence for good in the lives of other people as well, right? Because sometimes what they need is people like us to validate them or to cheerlead them or to say a kind word or to learn how to communicate better with them. So the opportunities to help people that are struggling and just become more and more meaningful in my life. And it's really my passion. And what my focus is, and my wife and I work on this together. We have a group, it's a selfless plug. It's called Craft Connect.
Put it out there.
And then the website is www.craftconnectfs.com. CraftConnectFS.com. And the idea is, friends, is that, you know, recovery from chronic health conditions, right? And that's what these are, whether it's mental health or substance use, needs to involve family. However you define what a family is, you know, we can't do this on our own. And so what we do is we teach skills to family members, and we do this virtually on Zoom, to help them to learn how to be more effective in their communication with the people that are struggling in their own lives, how to validate, how to plan, how to be more understanding of the nature of the conditions their loved ones are struggling with. And again, it all goes back to, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, what we do is we teach people skills every week, and we give them the confidence to use those skills. A lot of people throw their hands up in the air and say, I can't, I've given up. I can't affect the behavior of my loved one, you know, whether they're having a mental health challenge or using drugs or alcohol, you know, we know that people can have an influence and be a change agent, if you will, in the lives of their loved ones. And all we do is we break it down into little kind of steps, right, that people can go through in terms of helping them accomplish that. So, and then we also give people a safe place to share. So every week we'll do a series of hour and a half Zoom meetings in the evenings. Families come, parents, partners, grandparents, and we teach them skills and we give them a place to share their lived experience. And it's just tremendously satisfying work, you know, and again, you know, we just and using the internet, right? So we don't have to leave home. We talk to people all over the country every week that are dealing with these kinds of issues, and it makes a difference. We've collected enough data that we know that when people learn skills and start changing, their loved ones change in return. And you think about, you know, we're talking about faith. You think about what's the essence of Christianity, which is, you know, if we treat other people the way we want to be treated, something's going to change, right? You know, and so instead of yelling at your kids or getting totally frustrated with your partner because of their substance use problems, you know, is there a way you can be more empathetic, compassionate, more loving, and use some skills that you didn't know about before that could help them and help you in strengthening those relationships? So that's what we're doing, and just absolutely love that work. So
gosh, I love that.
So yeah, here's an interesting question. As you're talking, I'm having this thought. I can imagine this work is teaching you a lot about yourself, a lot about other people. As you work with these folks going through these challenges and struggles, what has this taught you about how God maybe sees these folks?
Yeah, great question, Mike. You know, and again, it reinforces one of my core beliefs, again, that God is no respecter of persons, right? I mean, and so that's number one. I do a writing workshop where I encourage people, and it's based on the science. You know, if people write for 20 minutes, they unlock deeper thoughts or feelings that help them to communicate trauma and other events in your life that you can't do when you just talk about them. And so I do this these workshops every week with about 50, 60 people. And the quality of what they talk about is just incredible. The experiences they've been through, you know, I'm looking at them and I have no idea just by outward appearances what they've been through, right? The traumas they've been through. And yet when they share their writing, you know, I get an insight, and other people get insights into what their lives are like. And so, you know, God is no respecter of persons. Tender mercies are real. Give you an example. You know, one of the assignments was, is there a time in your life when you felt the influence of a higher power? Okay, and this is in a non-religious setting, right? I'm just putting this out there. And one of the participants says, yeah, you know, I think there is. And this is the story. So I'm in my room, and I'm about ready to end my life. I'm going to hang myself in my closet. And all of a sudden, a white light came into that closet and came over me. And it changed my heart, and I didn't have a desire to harm myself anymore. I think that was the influence of a higher power.
And wow. My laughter is not taking anything away from the sacred nature of that. But yeah,
it was incredible because, guys, and why I'm laughing about it is I remember at the time, you know, this is in a group setting, and I'm looking around and people are nodding their heads. Mm. They have had that experience, you know, Mike or Tyler, but they knew what he was talking about because they had those tender mercies in their own lives and were realizing, oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had something like that. Maybe not that dramatic, maybe a lot of little things that have been a cumulative thing. But to me, that's the other part of this is realizing that, you know, no matter our challenges, you know, God doesn't judge us, right? We judge ourselves. We do a great job of doing that. You know, one of the things we always talk about is the idea of shame. That to me is the worst. And shame is, I'm a bad person, right? And sometimes that comes out of somebody's religious experience, right? Where they've been told, you mentioned it, keeping the command. I'm not keeping the commandments, so I'm a bad person, right? Mm-hmm. Well, no, I don't think there are any bad people. Well, I know there aren't any, you know? I mean, we make mistakes. We have challenges in our lives, but we're not a bad person. You know, we just are making maybe ineffective choices. You know, it's the term I like. You know, we're not being effective as we would.
And we can't fix those things without owning those choices. But I think a lot of times when we look at, I think of Michael Burke, Tyler, unmitigated trauma is the robber of hope, right? When there has been trauma and there is not work to address the trauma, you can expect poor choices, right?
Well, and I
you
think
can
too,
expect
Mike,
broken people reaching, trying to find something to help them stop hurting.
Yeah, I like the idea of like owning those choices, but not letting those choices define who you are, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we always say this to people and we say this to family members, you know, remember who your loved one really is, right? Remember, you know, you might have to go back to when they were 10 years old, right? Before they developed a behavioral health issue or started using substances. But go back to a time when you could remember who they are, you know, and focus on that, you know, and how can I help them, you know, understand that feeling. I went to a seminar a couple of years ago. There's a particular called borderline personality disorders. This is a very troubling diagnosis, very difficult diagnosis for a lot of people. Men and women both get it. So at the end of the 3-day seminar, you know, is run by the guy at Yale who runs the borderline group for, you know, that university, renowned expert. So he's the ending speaker. And you know, so we've been listening, 1,000 people around the world listening to all these people talk about how do you deal with this disorder. And so he's going to tell us now the summary of all the things that we should remember. I've got my pen ready to write it down.
Yeah, okay, here's the list.
Here it is, man. Here it is. And you know what he said? And this was, you know, he said, okay, this is what this is my final thought. I want you to remember these are people that you love. That was it. You know,
that was the thought.
It wasn't like a clinical thing. It wasn't like remember, do this, then do that. It wasn't a checklist. It was anything. It was like, remember, you know, these are people that you love. And so have that attitude. And I thought, okay, I love this guy. You know, it was a mix of clinicians, family members, government officials, whatever, you know, and to just keep reminding people, you know, people have challenges. That's what we need to do is we need to be loving. We need to be compassionate. Yes. And we need to use skills and medication and all those other things to help them in their recovery. But that ultimate, you know, faith value of mine is, you know, hey, we're all in this together. You know, we have a loving Heavenly Father and we've got to help one another any way we can, you know, and we all have limits. We all have skills and abilities, but whatever we can do to help, let's try it, you know, get it. Like you, the quote that you read, you know, you don't want to look back and think, okay, gee, you know, I missed an opportunity to have an influence for good on somebody because I didn't open my mouth or I was fearful or I wasn't sure if I would be received well or what are all the things we use to kind of judge ourselves about, oh, I'm not good enough to do that. I'm not a professional. I don't know what to say to somebody. Well, guys, you know, be loving, be listening.
Yeah, just love them.
And be engaged. So anyway.
John, given the work that you're involved in and even the experiences, some of the experiences that you've talked about in your career throughout the years, but what gives you hope these days?
Oh boy. I'm a visually oriented person. And so I see it around me all the time. And I'll tell you, that's a great question, Tyler. To me, it's like, I'll be at a restaurant and I'll see two people, not on their phones, like we always see, right? But they're actually talking to one another and they're communicating and something's happening between the two of them. That gives me hope. You know, they're making a connection there. I don't know anything about their lives. When I see people walking down the street holding hands or somebody hugging somebody or, you know, I can see that, you know, as a behavioralist, you know, we're always looking for things that we can observe. At least that's how we know if people have changed behavior. Can we see it, you know? And so when I see people doing those kinds of activities, to me, that gives me hope. If we lived in a world where I wasn't seeing that, I'd be very discouraged, but I see that. The other thing is just how people can, you know, what gives me hope is again, the groups of people I have the privilege of working with, I see them at least on a weekly basis, and I can see them change over time. You know, I can see the light in their eyes. You know, I mean, I can observe in their facial expressions or in the way they carry themselves or the way they communicate, I can see that change. And I, knowing a little bit about their history and what they've been through, the trauma that they've survived and the environmental impact and their biological background, all these things that have contributed to their condition, you know, that boy, that gives me hope, you know, that people can change. I think the other thing that I've gives, you know, and part of that too is an idea of accepting who we are, right? Is it this idea of we can do two things at the same time. We can accept our situation and the life that we have, and we can change, right? And we call that a dialectic. That's part of a skill group that I love, which is called dialectical behavioral therapy, but it's DBT is the short version of that. It's a wonderful set of skills, but it helps people have a life worth living because it's based on this idea. I'm going to accept myself, love myself, understand I'm doing the best I can in the moment, and I can do better, right? And I think that's, again, it goes back to a core value of faith, which is, okay, you know, Jesus met people where they were, right? Okay, I'm going to love you and accept you in spite of your challenges, and I'm going to expect you to change, right? And this is how I want you to change, right? Do those two things at the same time. And so that also gives me hope that's, you know, seeing how people can and do change. And it's just remarkable.
I love that, John. I love
right
that.
Right now, Sean McMasters is smiling. Our guest last week is a minister from another church here in my town. And he taught that same principle, right? Okay. Can we be okay with the striving and with the acknowledgement that we're going to fall short?
Yeah.
And can we hold them both? Right. Can we hang on to them? And he also taught us some powerful things about grace. And I've been thinking about grace all week. So I have a question for you, John, just this idea. Sometimes Tyler and I, there's a lot of things we don't understand. Right. We have often said that we're a couple of choices away from maybe a totally different lot in life, either choices that we make or maybe choices parents make. What thoughts do you have as you work with folks and you look at your background and you look at how you were raised? When we think about grace and this idea of grace being a part of our lot in life.
Yeah.
Acknowledging that you're in a place where maybe the folks that you're helping have never dreamed of having parents that you had or never dreamed of having a church community that you had. How does that land in your heart as you work with the folks that you're working with? If my question makes sense.
No, I think it makes absolute sense, and my answer probably won't make sense. But but this is the thing. I one of the things that I believe as part of my values is that the loving Heavenly Father that I know exists has confidence in us, and because He has confidence in us, He allowed us to come to this life and experience what it can be. You know. Mm. And everybody's experience is different. And I think, boy, you know, talk about a bold step, you know, to say, okay, John, you know, I have confidence that you're going to, you know, you're going to come through the other side one way or another. Right. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's, that may be another, maybe not grace, but I think it is. I think it's realizing, okay, and you're going to have the freedom to make choices, right? Yeah. And our, and does having a mental health disorder and a substance use disorder, does that affect the clarity of your thinking? Yeah, absolutely. Does it make it more challenging? But even with those kind of challenges, you still have basic choices. And so, for me, the idea of grace is realizing that also that, no one can do this on their own. You know, one of the things that I, there's a subtext in a lot of the behavioral health world that I disagree with. And this is this Western rugged individualism idea, which is, I can do anything, right? I can recover on my own. I can have a life worth living on my own. I can, you know, I mean, it's the Paul Simon, I'm a rock, I'm an island, right?
Right.
You know, and that's just not life. At least that hasn't been my experience. I know so many successful people. And if you really got a chance to talk to them, I think they say, you know, the essence of what I've shared was, you know, I achieved what I achieved because people gave me an opportunity. People believed in me. They supported me. They gave me a chance. You know, I think that's what God does with us. You know, to me, that's the grace, is that we, and the other thing I think, the idea of time, we talked about this a minute, you know, time is only known to man, I think is what one of the scriptures talks about, you know. But isn't it fascinating that we're designed as biological beings that are on a 24-hour kind of cycle? So we have a day experience, then we go to bed, and then guess what? We get up, it's a new day. Oh my goodness, that means I could change, right? Think about it, if the day lasted 1,000 years.
I've had a few of those, I think, but
maybe it's podcasts that have lasted 1,000 hours, right? Yeah. But anyway, you know, I just think, you know, so here we're set up to succeed, right? Because okay, it's a reset, right? If we can sleep at night, and some people have a challenge with that, and we try and help them do that, get a good night's sleep. But you get up the next morning, you realize, okay, I could have a totally different experience this day, right? Than I had the day before. And I think that the wonderful people I get a chance to work with, I think they start to realize that, right? I'm not, like you talked about, I'm not who I was before. My behaviors don't define me. My addictions don't define me. You know, I'm me, right? And I'm going to accept that that's part of my life. That's part of my current experience. And today I'm going to do something different. I'm going to change. Right. I'm going to be better, you know, because even though some of these problems I didn't create, I got to solve them. Right. And that's being accountable, you know, to yourself and to others, you know, does that feel like what grace?
Oh, man. Okay. So there's just some things every once in a while that I hear that just allow me to kind of ease the tension in my shoulders. Right, and just the idea of God having confidence in us.
I was going to say that. Highlight that point, Mike.
That's
awesome. Yeah,
let's go. And you know what else I was thinking too, John, as you were talking, just that idea of Helaman's 2,000 stripling warriors. No one died, but they were
all wounded. Hurt. Yeah,
and this idea of coming out on the other side, just come here and wage the battles that need to be waged, and learn what needs to be learned. And on the other side, his grace is sufficient, and we may be wounded.
Right. Yeah.
But on the other side, right, there's confidence that we're going to be able to make it.
Yeah. And I love that idea, Mike, of, and John, I love those words and that thought, because I love the idea of God having confidence in us, even though our confidence will wax and wane throughout, right, our experiences. But the confidence God has in us does not change, right? I love that idea. I love that idea.
And it's not confidence in an us that isn't real.
100%.
He is confident in you and me right now.
Well, John, you said he has confidence, and that's why he allowed us to come here.
yeah,
and have these experiences.
Knowing.
Right.
Like, hey, son, here's the keys to the car. I know you're going to make a mess of things, but I have confidence in you.
And I've seen this in my life, and you have too. And I see this every day with the people I work with. You know, this idea of weak things become strong, right? You know, yeah. And that's a reality. That happens. The one thing, just to go back to the faith thing, and this just become kind of a pet. Well, I've gotten a lot of encouragement from people, but sometimes we get confused, and this happens to people regardless of what faith they're a part of or what religion they belong to. We get confused about that it's all about the gospel of outcomes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense to me. It's not about the gospel of outcomes. Okay, if I do these things, then I'm going to have a happy life, right? You know,
right.
If I don't do these things, I'm going to have a miserable life.
Very transactional, yeah, right?
I don't think that makes sense. But what makes sense to me, and you hear references of this in all kinds of scriptures, that what is possible is even though we're in pain, we're in difficulty, is the nature of that can change, right? Yeah. We can learn how to bear that pain, right? We can learn how to bear that pain. You know, last 2 weeks ago was the LDS General Conference. President Nelson, the prophet of the church, who I you know, follow and believe in, you know, he's delivering. If you remember, he's delivering his address seated, and he mm-hmm. spent a great deal of time talking about he got injured and he's in pain. Right? He didn't say, you know, you listen to what he talked about. He didn't say he was not in pain. He said, "I'm still in pain from this injury." Right?
Right.
But he's able to bear the pain enough to deliver the talk and have a smile on his face and focus on sharing his beliefs with others, you know. So this, so to me, I think a lot of times we get confused. We think, okay, that outcome is, you know, if we don't get that outcome, that means that we're, again, back to the idea of we're a bad person.
Right.
Whereas that's not what it's about. It's about, you know, can we get through the pain? Can a stripling warrior survive getting wounded and the horrific things that they went through fighting those battles, never having done that before in their lives? Think about it. You know, I mean, my goodness, talk about trauma, you know,
as
a young adult, you know, being put in that situation, but they were able to bear it, you know, and that's, I think that's another part of the grace, you know.
I think that puts deliverance in a whole new light, right? As you think about shades of deliverance being sometimes the thing is taken and sometimes the burden is made light because I have been strengthened to carry it, right? I know a long time ago, I did a number on my right knee. I know how much it hurt. For whatever reason, I don't feel it anymore. I probably altered my gait, right? Like, I know when I get older, that pain's going to come knocking like, hey, remember me.
Right, yeah. Right.
But I mean, I think that sometimes we do live to endure some things that at one time were heavy and at one time hurt us. Yeah. But as we exercise faith, right? Cause I'm 100% with you, John. We cannot do this alone.
Well, I think there's lessons learned through our experience, right? Like perspective changes through experience, you know, and I think I always think about, as you guys are talking, I'm thinking about 1 Nephi 17, and there's some verses in there where Nephi talks about how, hey, we lived in the wilderness and we survived on raw meat and it was terrible, but oh man, the blessings of God on us were so great. You know, two or three verses later, his brothers are sharing the exact same experience. And they say, we were in the desert, we lived on raw meat, and it would have been better off if we would have died, right? Mm-hmm. So these two exact same experiences, but totally different, you know, outlooks on what that was all about. And I think that when we go through experiences and we allow our perspectives to be changed and to start to recognize the good in the difficult times, the burden becomes lighter, right? Bearable, more bearable, but not easy. So.
Yeah, and I think that's a role that I like to play in working with the people that I get a chance to, which is to help them realize that, you know?
Yeah.
It's to look back on that and shift that perspective. Yeah, you may have thought that way, but now look at it now in the rearview mirror, you know?
Yeah.
What came out of that experience, you know, being in the wilderness? this is what you said at the time. But now look at that experience.
I love that. Can I get personal?
Yes, sir.
You mentioned this sweet companion that you have. How did you guys meet?
Finished a mission for the LDS Church. I moved to Salt Lake, which I never intended to do. I started going to the University of Utah, and I went to a student ward there. And fortunately, she was in that student ward, and we got to know one another. And I fell in love with her, and she's just a unique person that has just been a blessing in my life, and allowed me to have the fun that I've had working and kind of trying to help other people and just put up with me.
Tyler, I wish our listeners could see John's face light up as he talked about his wife. And I hope my face lights up when I talk about Kelly Freeman the way you talk about your wife 20 years from now, right? What's her name?
Her name is Kristen. And Kristen. She's listening in. So guys.
Okay. Got it. Well, I can warm my hands by the love you have for her. So I appreciate that.
Right. But this is the thing. And I think this is finding the right life partner, right? Talking about the success I've had in life. I don't know if both of you are married, if you have partners, but anyway, this is so key, unfortunately, we live in a time, particularly with young adults and a lot of the folks that I work with, where people don't feel comfortable making those kind of commitments to finding a life partner or can't find anybody. Trying to meet people online. I know people do that. It works. But, I think, wow, that would be so, so challenging, having that companionship, it's just made all the difference in my life. And and again, part of my core beliefs goes back to my parents. They were committed to one another, no doubt, right? I mean, they through thick and thin, the kids, the work, the challenges with living, and that's something that I've been grateful for. They always set that example of commitment to their partners and to their family. So
John, with everything you've been through, can you paint me a picture? You love to tell stories, and I would love to get an idea from you. Can you paint me a picture where you mentally took a picture looking around? It was maybe who you were with, maybe the experience, maybe the scenery or the setting where you looked around and said, right now, this is rich.
Okay. Oh boy, I have had so many of those opportunities.
Well, you've been to New Zealand, so yeah. You've been to Israel, right? Yeah, there's been some.
A lot of different places in the world. I think there's just a variety of experiences, but they would all revolve around my family. Times when we've been able to be together and just enjoy being together. We recently had one of the kids got married. Everybody was there, the children, the grandchildren, the friends, the family. And it was just wonderful, to enjoy the experience and to realize, I don't know how much I had to do with any of this, but I felt rich, to me, it's all about, the relationships, the people. I have a lot of friends that have become very successful, very wealthy in the media business, and I, that hasn't been me, right? Because I made other choices. I feel I'm the richest man in town. I mean, I really do because of that, and those settings that I've been in with my family when we've just enjoyed being together. That has been you know, those have been sustaining and experiences that I look back on with so much fondness, you know. So
love them. I love it, John. I think that you know, it's interesting. We it's been fun kind of talking and learning about your experiences and learning about what is defines a rich life for you. And you know, for us, this podcast really is it's an exploration, right? I mean, John, Mike and I always talk about that we're a bit of we got some wobbly wheels, and we're, you know, we got to figure out how to live this life and do it the right way. And it's great to talk to people like yourself. And if we go back to George Bailey, you know, one of the scenes in that movie that Mike and I always talk about that we love is when George is at that bridge and he has that realization of his life and how meaningful it is. And he offers that prayer to God and he says, "I want to live again." And we love that when he has that realization. And so, John, we close out every episode of this podcast with the same question. And we're going to offer that question to you today. What does it mean to you to be considered the richest man in town?
For me, being the richest man in town means that I'm content with my life, that I'm at peace with my situation, that I don't have a life full of regrets, of missed opportunities with the people I care about or the opportunities to make a difference. You know, and to me, that's made my life rich and meaningful. I have so many, I've had so many opportunities over the years that have reinforced that idea of being blessed, right? With those kind of riches. And it has nothing to do with material things. You know, I'm grateful that I don't have to worry about that. I've been to parts of the world where people spend their lives going to the bathroom outside, right? And that's just part of their life. You know, they're not rich. They're living in shacks and you know, situations that we would not be able to tolerate, but that's the life that they're used to. And I've met so many of those people that are, you know, in ways richer than I am, you know, because of the values they have, how they're living their life, the difference they're making in their communities. And so, you know, so it's not about the material things. It's about relationships and am I living my life congruent to the values that I believe. And when I do that, I feel like I'm rich, you know. When I'm not living those values, I feel like I'm missing it. You know, I'm not doing everything I can be or be everything I should be. So,
yeah. Well, I love that answer. And it's one of the fun things about this podcast is to be able to get on here with someone I've never met before, John, and have a conversation. And I walk away feeling rich because of the life that you're living and the difference that you're making. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate you sharing those things with us tonight.
Well, guys, this is, you know, this sounded like a fun idea when I was approached, and you've made it a fun experience for me. So thanks so much for letting me share. I hope some of what I said makes sense. And again, I love that you're kind of modeling this after a movie that I love, you know, A Wonderful Life. And I really feel like that. I have had a wonderful life. I can say that, you know, without being prideful, but just realizing, well, you know, that's been my experience, you know, and I'm great.
John, it's clear because other people who know you are reaching out saying you got to talk to John.
Okay.
So that's evidence. That's evidence that you're doing something right. And Tyler, we started talking about, I kind of let you in on a core belief, and then John joined the conversation. And we started talking about values, and Tyler, you probably picked up as John was talking to us, he would preface some of his answers by saying, "Well, one of my core values is," right? Mm-hmm. "One of my core," and I love that. And one of my beliefs is the best answer is a simple one. Right. And I loved your answer about being content, because in 2023, think about what our world would look like if people were just content with what they had, content with the people that they had in their lives, content with their lot in life, content with their ability to learn and improve themselves, right? Versus contention. And yeah. I think that those three little letters on the end of that word are changing our world right now. And I think that we're all about it. We're all about starting a little movement with this podcast project, anything that we can do to help people understand the power of simple answers, giving us that rich life. So we really, really appreciate the things you shared with us tonight.
Thanks, Mike. And I think it all starts, contentment to me all starts to go back to the acceptance and change idea. If we can accept our situation, where we are, what's happening in our lives, and really accept it, right? And embrace it even, lean into that pain, whatever the challenges are. And at the same time, change. That to me, that would change everything, right? And starting with accepting where we are, right? And
really accepting.
Really right? Accepting. We call it.
I think of guests we've had, Tyler. I think of Portia being in prison and accepting, and instead of blaming, leaning into the pain of the choices that she made. Right. I mean, I love that idea of not just kind of token going through the motions of accepting, but actually doing inventory and really accepting our current situation, and then changing,
getting into it with both feet. Right. You know, diving deep in the pool, whatever that metaphor is. But yeah, I'm going to go all the way. I'm going to be accepting of that. And boy, if people could do that and realize they can still change and be better.
There's some power there, right? Powerful. And yesterday doesn't remember.
Yeah.
I love John. Thank you. This has been so much fun. And I'm grateful to you.
Thanks for the opportunity. So, I really enjoyed meeting both of you. This I love this idea, and I'll be interested to see how this turns out. So,
well, you know my number now, and we will call again. So don't screen my call.
I won't do that. I promise. All right, take care, guys.
Thanks, John.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Good idea, Ernie. A toast to my big brother George. The richest man in town.